Richard Sarafian. Three, two, one. Hello and welcome to The Green Room. I'm John Tibbetts, and our always mobile location this time is in the West Coast in Hollywood, in the home of Richard Sarafian, director and actor, whose roots, incidentally, in part at least, take him back to Kansas City, so there's even a local connection for this interview. He's a man that you're seeing on TV right now in Foley Square. You've also seen his films like Man in the Wilderness and Vanishing Point, a film that certainly that I want to talk about very shortly, because Richard Sarafian, what originally brought me to you was Vanishing Point, a film I saw many years ago, admired greatly before I knew who you were at all, and darned if I'm not now sitting across from your kitchen table talking with you. Does it happen very often that people come to you because of something they've seen of yours, that in turn has then led them to your doorstep? Does that sort of thing happen very often?
Really?
Really?
Really. It seems like people are shy. I mean, that they admire you, and some of them may write you a letter, but never do they, you know, ever make a move where they will come to your door and sit down and ask you about it.
Nonetheless, when you confront, let's say, students or today's film going public, does the film Vanishing Point, for example, come up very often?
Yeah, as a matter of fact, it does, yeah. The kids that have seen it remember it and admire it, and I'm always pleased, you know, that I might go someplace where someone would mention Vanishing Point as being one of his favorite films.
It could best be described, I guess, as a kind of a surreal road picture, a high-speed chase, among other things. And I love the character of the black, blind disc jockey, whose voice accompanies this entire speed trek westward. What were some of those elements that especially appealed to you? Was all of this in the script, or was some of this film sort of extemporized as it went on?
The black disc jockey wasn't black in the original script. Mm-hmm. It was meant to be Spanish. It was called Super Spick instead of Super Soul. And Dick Zanuck decided that that wouldn't do, and that we should change it to a Super Soul. It was based on a character called Ratman Jack. I don't know if anybody's ever heard of him. It's the old Ratman coming to you from station whatever it is, 60,000 kilowatts, a soul power baby. he's a popular disc jockey, at least in this part of the world. The script was written by, oddly enough, someone who had never been in this country except once. He was Castro's Minister of Information at one time and is now an expatriate living in London. However, possibly, well, he must have been a student of Kerouac and read The Road. And the script, however, I must say, was brilliantly crafted. All of that which was in it was meant to be, possibly beyond that. The ending, there was a different ending, other than a man driving a bulldozer and dying. The concept that he had is that he went right through it onto another level. It was a man who was into the molecule of speed, and who was as pragmatic a character as Kowalski was. For him, once he got into that molecule, there was no reentry. Mm-hmm. So the analogy being is that we're all moving through this planet at our own varying speeds, each one on to another destiny, and that this is not the reality, that he's on to another place, going on to another place. So, so when I made the film and showed Dick Zanuck the ending, where Super Soul is not mourning his death, but actually has encouraged it, because that was his final escape, Zanuck said, no, that won't do, the audience will never buy that. So I've yet to make that picture. I mean, that's coming up. I may make Vanishing Point, too, where that concept becomes clear.
During the story sessions, however, you mentioned Dick Zanuck. Did anybody at any time say, what is going on in this film? This is not a straightforward thriller narrative that maybe they had thought it would be.
I never had any contact with Zanuck at all. During the making of the film, I had only one meeting with him prior to making it. And he asked me only one question. He said, does he die at the end?
Which is a very good question.
And I said, it depends on your view. As far as I'm concerned, he doesn't.
Why Barry Newman in that role?
That was my question. I mean, I didn't want Barry Newman. I didn't think Barry Newman was the right actor for the part. I had available to me George C. Scott, who at that time just finished Patton, and who had made and earned the right to do anything after that performance, who wanted to do the film. And my concept was the adult male behind the wheel of the car. Mm-hmm. And someone who was beyond Barry Newman's age, who fell in a much younger category. And but Scott wasn't acceptable to the studio for whatever reason. Naturally, he would have wanted a lot more money. The second choice that I had was Gene Hackman behind the wheel of the car. And again, he wasn't acceptable, and the studio insisted that Barry Newman play the character. In fact, to the point where if he did not play the character, I was not going to make the picture.
This is typical of the life of a director who has to put up with decisions that maybe were not his own, but now you have to implement them. Has that ever worked out to your advantage, do you think, when something that seemed to be a drawback or a misfire, you were able to work to your advantage?
It's constantly going on in the business where sometimes the people who put up the money impose their attitudes or their requirements on you, and you try to convert them into a plus. I mean, you don't surrender at that point. I think that Barry Newman functioned very well in the picture. It just might have been a bit different. So the picture that I had in mind, no one has ever seen, or no one ever will see.
Yeah.
And so I've still, that's why I said I hope to be able to make Vanishing Point 2 someday.
In a film filled with so much speed and work with lots of cars and things, did you participate in the second unit direction yourself also?
There wasn't any.
Or was there such a thing as a second unit on that?
We didn't have enough money to afford a second unit. In fact, the picture was all action. Most of it was action. And my when I finally agreed to Barry Newman, I said to Zanuck that I will make the car the star of the picture and an extension of the personality. He says, I knew you'd come around.
Such a bizarre picture of the American landscape. The snake healing, the religious cult with the snakes, that stands out vividly as well.
That had to be readjusted. That wasn't meant to be exactly that way. There was a snake cult. In other words, we attempted to get into various cults and some of that was part of the American canvas, the American tapestry, the American scene. However, when Bonnie and Delaney and friends and Rita Coolidge arrived in the desert, they would not participate. Their religion, their own religion, would not allow them to get involved in an estate cult. So I immediately adjusted the script so that the old trapper arrives on the scene with his snakes, with his vipers, and Zevon Dodden says, no, we don't need the snakes anymore. We have the music, and he says, free the snakes and threw them back into the desert.
Well, a memorable image.
That was all improvised.
Now, I'm trying to remember the name of the gentleman who was in that role. As I was saying, the elderly gentleman who portrayed the trapper, a veteran of so many, and I can't remember his name now, the veteran of so many...
Dean Jagger.
Dean Jagger. I'd never seen him in a more disquieting kind of image. Did he ever offer up any objections to that kind of portrayal?
No, not at all. I mean, there were two men. There was
the old man, the bald-headed man.
The bald-headed man was Dean Jagger. No, not at all. He was quite a guy.
He loved it.
Incredible, of course. He loved being out in the desert and hanging out with us and dancing at night and really became part of the group. I mean, it was a very committed group of actors and technicians. It was a close family, is the way films should be made. We had very little money that Fox gave us, absolutely none. I mean, according to our standards, a little over $1 million. And doing a union picture for 20th Century Fox, where you have to live by all the rules, is not, at least, not a lot of money. With some very complicated stunts to do, a lot of demands on the action and the precision that went into it and the design of the action. So it took a commitment from everybody, and if that's the most purest form of working, and Foxes didn't keep their hand in it. They sort of left us alone. There wasn't enough money, I guess, for them to really worry about us until when I finally came back and glued it all together. Zanuck said only one thing. He said, I like it. And he said, just do this and that. Two small changes. Went that small to me at the time, and I was nudged by David Brown, his associate, and he and Zanuck are joined at the hip today.
A very interesting partnership, isn't it?
Yeah, but I mean, both of them are really lovely men, and I think and the kind of guys you like to work with. I mean, they get right to the bottom line. What can I do to help you, But it was, I liked the picture, and that was it.
I want to remind everyone, we're in the home of Richard Sarafian, and we're not in Hollywood, technically, I guess. Brentwood?
Yeah, I would rather think that we're outside of Hollywood from all the neon signs and
And thus far we've been discussing Vanishing Point, 1970, 71?
Yeah, about then, yeah.
Now, let's stay with it just long enough to find out what happens with a film that is this idiosyncratic, I guess is a good way of putting it. What happened to it after production and release? Did the studio follow through with promotions? I saw it in an army theater when I was in the service, but did it get a wide distribution?
The film, Zanuck, what happened with the film is that there was an element of the film that I did not want, I didn't think would came off as well as it should, and that was his relationship with the girlfriend. She had been involved in, I don't know what. But anyhow, the actress that arrived on the set was not the same girl I cast out in New York. After a day, I called Zanuck. I said, she has to be replaced. He said, follow through, Richard, at the end of the picture when you cut it together. If she's not correct, we'll redo those sequences. When that time came, Zanuck was fired. Mom and Dad got together and said, Richard, the studio isn't working out anymore. I mean, we have problems with the bank. You've got to go. I tried to call Richard for him to fulfill, you know, his promise on my marker. And they said, you can't talk to him. On the lot, nobody can talk to him. The new broom came in, swept everybody out. And, of course, this wasn't his child. And he had none of the paternal feelings towards it. And I was off in Spain somewhere, and nobody, as far as I knew, was really pushing the film. In fact, they tried to pull it out of release. What happened with the film was that the audience would not allow it to be pulled out of release. The people that lined up to watch it, the people that saw it, became big fans of the picture. And much to their surprise, it held on and held on and held on, as it does today. I mean,
how do you react to something said by someone such as I when I say that I've shown this film in college classrooms before, both in terms of its technique and of its place in a certain kind of road picture that Hollywood was producing at that time? Do you feel proud of that? Does it make you a bit self-conscious to think of your films being studied by a new generation of filmgoers like that? And that 71 is not such a long time ago.
I mean, of course. I mean, when you do something and you devote your time and your love and all your energies to something, is you hope that it's being appreciated by someone. If it itself becomes an example of a style, or it sets a genre of filmmaking, which I think in many ways it did, then I think that's even more fulfilling for the filmmaker, for myself.
Because I think it will live more than a film like, say, Scarecrow or Easy Rider, both other entries in that style.
Well, each has its own place and its own style. Scarecrow, I would say, yeah, I'd probably stand up against Scarecrow. For Easy Rider, had its own style. I probably stole a little bit of Easy Rider when I made Vanishing Point in terms of a dancing camera. Some of the things that happened by mistake. I cut a whole reel together of camera mistakes and made it into a piece, became a piece of virtuoso film editing in terms of movement and also discovery for me in terms of getting into the molecule of speed. And that happened several years before when I was shooting an autistic, not a child, trying to run, who couldn't run. So you get a sense of the spirit of the child being ahead of him. And that's what I was trying to get with the car, and with the camera dancing in and around, that the spirit of Kowalski was even moving outside of the car that he was encased in.
Now, you're alluding to some other pictures, and so we need to get into that. And I guess shortly, though, I have to back up and catch who you were in 1970 and 71. What place in the filmmaking profession did you occupy at that time? And then let's go back to some of your beginnings. Where were you in your profession in 1970?
I guess I was the beginning of the height. I mean, the beginning of an important time in my life. I had just paid a lot of dues. I had made two other films. One was the first one I made came in 1963. It was called Andy. It was about a retarded man, a black and white film, which I did in New York for absolutely no money. I mean, when I say no money, no money for Universal, they left me alone.
Way ahead of the Mickey Rooney series on television.
Way ahead of Charlie, which became an important film. This particular film went to the Cannes Film Festival and won during International Week. Although Universal didn't want the film, in a way they didn't want to support it, they said, you have absolutely no chance. I begged them to go, and they said, no, you have no chance. In fact, when I came back after making the film in New York and we sat around the table with the executives, their reaction to the film was, can you come up with a shorter title?
How do you react to something like that?
You just sort of choke on your peanut butter sandwich. I mean, that's about the only thing. There was nothing I could do. They had no, they couldn't care. When you invest so little, you know, their investment is that little. They know they could write it up. They look at it as a noble experiment. It doesn't follow any of the guidelines. Universal at that time was torn between the new administration and the old. It seems like I always arrived at that time. And this was the old guard, as opposed to Lou Wasserman, who is now a monolith in the business, I guess. And it was his idea. I think he encouraged the idea of developing and helping new young filmmakers. What I'll explain is that Andy, at that time, was an attempt to encourage new young filmmakers. The reaction of Newsweek at that time was that the jury is still out on whether or not I was a new young filmmaker, but as far as discovering untalent, there it was. It was a kind of a cruel thing to say. Indeed. Reporters have asked me, said, what about something like that? I said, well, if that reporter ever arrives on my doorstep in Hollywood, I'll kill him.
But you can kind of make light of it now, but at the time, it must have really hurt a lot.
It was devastating. It was devastating. I saw the picture in a theater with only five people in it on opening night during a blizzard. I think three of the five were my mother, my sister, and my nephew. And I went back to my hotel room, opened up the window, and looked out. I mean, about 18 floors down. And that was about a year's work or 6 months and all my dreams, you know, and no one in the theater. You overcome that. And you come back, and the studios don't care. It does go. It does win its awards. It does find its place in the hearts of some people somewhere in some part of the world who embrace it as being a special film. But I could not make another film for 5 years after that.
So that's where Run Wild, Run Free comes in?
That comes in 5 years later, after I had gone back to television so I could earn a living and keep working as a director. Finally, Columbia allowed me to make this small picture about an autistic child. And I went from retarded to autistic.
Now, are you getting branded already by an establishment as being a problem director, not literally, but dealing with problem topics? And is that a problem in itself?
I think that, I don't know if I'm being branded now or I was then, because I haven't done that much recently in the way of important films or is that I think Andrew Saris described me in The Village Voice as being the most misunderstood of the auteurs. And not that you deal with problems so much as that you try to make films that at least deal in some way with the human condition.
He did include you in one of his categories. Yeah. I couldn't recall that.
Most misunderstood. I'll accept that. If I'm the most of anything, you know, that pleases me.
That's the sort of thing that can lead to interesting conversations. Have you met him since the book came out?
No, I haven't. No, I haven't had an opportunity to meet him, but I appreciate him thinking about me in any category.
You talked about paying your dues now. In that regard, let's go back further. I had mentioned Kansas City initially. After the Korean War, where in those years afterwards did you end up in Kansas City? Because you were not born in Kansas City.
After the Korean War, went back to New York, and after a few months there, called Robert Altman, who I had met, who was a native, and who became a good friend, and asked him if he could help me work in documentaries where he was. He was with the Calvin Company. And I said, sure, come on out. And after a few months, I found myself working as an assistant to him, and within weeks after that, went off and made a documentary for the United Funds and became a director for the Calvin Company.
How long a time period are we talking about?
I think from the time that I left the Army until I became a director was about 6 months.
Did that then generate a bond between you and Mr. Altman that has prevailed still?
The bond disappeared, and I married his sister.
Are you saying one is a consequence of the other?
It was just a strange turn of events. Bob is his own man. He runs his own store. And it was now The Apprentice was moving into a level where he was in a position to compete with the master. And however that was viewed by Bob, we sat down one day, and I had written Andy at that time this film about the retire, and he said, I want to buy the film. I said, no, that's one that I'm keeping for myself, Bob,
because he wanted to make it with Dan Blocker. And I said, who he was doing Guns Bananas at the time. I said, no, I really, this is a kind of my own baby, my child, and I don't want to sell it. And he told me, he says, Richard, he said, I'll do you the best favor anyone can do. He said, I'm going to become your worst enemy in Hollywood. And for whatever reason that happened, I don't know. He might have had a couple of boozes at the time, but that's what happened.
Of course, in his own career, there's been that trek back to Broadway. Has that ever been something you two have done, gone back to the living stage, so-called, as a director?
No, Bob has done it successfully and has entered into that world. I of course, entertained the idea, but I thought before I ever did something like that, I would like to feel that I'm really succeeding or have succeeded in what I'm doing, mm-hmm. and that's making films. I'm comfortable in that area, but it's a whole new, you know, it keeps opening up in terms of the possibilities and what I would like to be able to bring to it.
In your film career, of course, Man in the Wilderness is another name, Man Who Loved Cat Dancing. These pictures all involved in one way or another men of highly individualized directions. Richard Harris, for example, what was it like working with him?
Richard is a very complex character. I mean, he is a lover on one side and can hate with an equal passion. I would say the best way to describe him, he's an Irishman. I mean, he likes to fight, and he loves to drink. I mean, he did none of that, however, while we were working on the picture. He's a totally committed artist, a man of tremendous passion. And we became great friends, very close, and on the basis of that, we were able to survive incredibly difficult circumstances and make that.
What were the locations?
Well, the locations were Spain, and Spain in winter in some of the coldest places and under the coldest and most difficult circumstances I've ever been involved in, with John Huston, who had just been fired from the picture. I found him in Spain. He said, I'd like to do the script, Richard, you know. Can I shave my head? I said, that won't be necessary.
What goes through your mind when a character like John Huston says, I'd like to do your script? Am I opening a kind of Pandora's box in bringing him on board?
Well, naturally, I'm flattered, but I'm also scared to death. I still have my heroes, and I still admire him so much, and did at the time. So it took me some time to get over the fact that I was working with this man who I admired so. But John helped me through it. You know, we became very close. We played backgammon at night, and he just stood at a distance and. I could see him kind of watching me out of the corner of his eye. And he doesn't preach to you, but he did give me one bit of advice. He said, Richard, of all the films I've ever done, I've always tried, always done my best. However, he says, there have been times, on occasion, he says, when my reason for doing a film hasn't been absolutely pure. He says, in those instances, he says, Richard, I could see the whole thing crumble before my very eyes, and there's not a thing you can do about it. He says, now, my advice or my suggestion to you, if you will, is get your family set up, get them on the way, get them out of the way, and then get on with the job. Hmm. So he kind of understood that the dilemma that sometimes that the filmmaker falls into is to create a space with family and obligations that doesn't always allow him to function, or the director to function as purely as it like you. Often find yourself committing to bread and butter jobs.
Yeah. And indeed, coming through all of your words are indications of a rootlessness or a nomadic kind of existence, at least, and having to put up with a variety of obstacles and interferences. You must have to have a very particular kind of survival instinct to make it through such things.
Well, I come out of a situation with parents, you know, who survived, a difficult time being Armenian immigrants. I came out of a very difficult time coming out of New York City and the streets of New York City where, surviving that area. And it's not so much survival. I guess I don't think of it in terms of survival as sort of reaching for a dream or reaching for, you know, to try and function as best you can. When you see there is a potential, at least feel it within yourself, is hopefully to create, and having it happen once mm-hmm. or twice, reaching for that kind of magic, which you're capable of doing, you know, working with film.
Have you ever wanted to reach back to that kind of boyhood experience in your own films? I'm thinking of other films like Hester Street that I think have been partially successful by other filmmakers to go back into that kind of childhood experience.
I did, I think, in a couple of instances, in a maybe not so obvious way. I did with Andy when I was dealing with the child wandering the streets of New York, trying to make human contact with whoever would pay any attention to him. I did with the autistic child who was, which was the, at least in my story, the springtime of his life, and who looked back into nature to find his own place in it. I did with Richard Harris in the involvement of the child who then, because of whatever disappointments he had, was fighting against nature, fighting against God.
And
eventually,
an interesting parallel, yeah.
And then found his place by ultimately seeing the harmony that's within it and falling within that pattern, mm-hmm. and finding some contentment, you know, and then going on with his life. I think in Vanishing Point, the child is there, in moving, you know, through time and space and through that American scene, and maybe us possibly on. So the child remains, and I hope it can continue to remain. I mean, I would like to feel that whatever I do will be a sum total of all my experiences, maybe some of the most intense being when I was a child. I think I'm still a child. I refuse to grow up, at least for myself and in the eyes of many of my contemporaries. I remain the child.
Richard Serafin, as you begin to draw together some of the thematic strands of your work, I'm wondering if there are other commentators, theorists, authors, biographers who are at the present time doing just that with your work, with your life. Is there anything being written extensively on your work, be it a college dissertation or somebody following your career in magazine articles, things like that?
There's been journalists who have come to me from time to time and have written articles. There's a magazine article that pretty much describes my attitude, at least what, you know, at the time. I find that I am being discussed in various universities, and when that happens, again, as I said, it pleases me.
Do you go over to UCLA or USC at any time to present your work?
I don't know why. I mean, I could, but I've never done that. For some reason or other, first of all, I'm kind of shy before a large audience, and yet there have been times when I have succeeded before an audience. I find it difficult as an artist to explain my work. I think that
those artists that are very adept at explaining their work, sometimes I distrust. Do you?
I think it best be left to the critics and for the audience to evaluate a man's work, and they're so much better at it than the artist. I think very often the artist sort of stumbles into certain things that he had no, you know, it just comes out of experience. It comes out of the fact that he is indeed an artist, and that everything isn't articulated, everything isn't that planned to the extent that the critics. I mean, I don't believe that Melville sat down and wrote all that wonderful, that marvelous book with planning it to the extent, I mean, with all the incredible symbols that were part of it. I think to a degree he did, yes. But the criticism they want after mm-hmm. that is endless. And I think as it is with films. I think I would like to think that I function organically, that within the center of that is an idea. Within the center of all my work, I would like to think that I'd like to be able to say that I view humanity in a positive way and with some hope for survival, that we're good people, and then that we're not doomed to failure. You know, I would rather see that. And I would like to think in my sum total of my work that that was what Serafin was reaching for.
I want to remind everybody I'm talking to Richard Serafin at his home in Brentwood outside Hollywood, California. We're talking about movies, presently about television, but first about acting. I'd like to bring in the name Sidney Pollack here. In the first place, both of you have done wonderful films about the wilderness. His Jeremiah Johnson, your Man of the Wilderness. Was there somewhere in there a point of kinship that the two of you reached? What involvement has he had in your life? Did it stem from there or from elsewhere? Because he has had an effect on your acting.
Sidney... And I knew each other. I met Sidney when he was an embryo director doing Ben Casey. That's how he got started.
Oh, so both of you were in TV then?
We were both in TV. He arrived out of TV and managed his career very well. He went to Spain to scout locations for Jeremiah Johnson and rejected Spain as being the place where he could do a story about the Great Northwest, and came back and shot it in Utah, I believe. Both those films, Man and Willis and Jeremiah Johnson, arrived at the same time. Unfortunately, they were both produced by Warner Brothers, and his cost three times what mine did. And I'm not saying one is qualitatively better than the other. I thought he made a wonderful film in Jeremiah Johnson. Nevertheless, Warner Brothers chose to put their money, advertising budget, into Jeremiah Johnson and with Robert Redford, and kind of ignored Man in the Wilderness. The main reason for that may be that they felt, was Jeremiah mentioned, Jeremiah Johnson was a far superior film. But nevertheless, it was a while after that that we would meet from time to time, maybe socially, in London. And it wasn't until sometime later that I got a call to come down and read for Sidney Pollack to do a picture with Willie Nelson and Chris Christopherson. And I did two or three readings with Sidney. He gave me the okay sign. Before I knew it, I was an actor working in a picture that he was producing called Songwriter with...
And of course, he was hot on the heels of his own notice as an actor in Tootsie.
Well, Sidney was an actor before he ever directed. And so Sidney left acting to direct. I had never been an actor. Right? I mean, I had acted once back in the Resident Theater in Kansas City in a play that Robert Altman directed while I was in the Army. That just about stopped it for me, because my girlfriend, who then became my wife, came running backstage afterwards with her arms wide open saying, "Richard, you were adequate." the only way I could get back at her was to marry her.
I love that. Well, in the meantime, you, Marty Ritt, so many other notable directors came out of television. What proving ground is there today for the young director to test his spurs, as it were? Or is there a parallel arena now?
Oh, this is wide open for anybody who's lazy. I mean, I teach a class and several classes, this is a way of me getting away from this apartment and back to where I began, and encourage them just to go out and make their own films.
Do you teach?
It's called Professional Artist Workshop. Next week I'm starting a workshop and teaching children how to make films for nothing.
Now, where is that? Where are you doing this?
Down in Highland and in Hollywood. But what I encourage kids to do today, if they want to make films, as I've gone to universities, I've talked at universities, and I love being around kids because their questions are really quite astute. They can be brutal and they can be cruel. But when I ask the question, if it was within your means to make a movie, what would you make? They stare at you. But the idea reaches them, and they'll find me later because they're too shy to articulate it, or maybe I haven't ever thought of it in that sense. But for kids today, it was simply to get a still camera and practice with that, to get an 8mm camera and just go out and write a script. And if it's 1 minute, 2 minutes, 3 minutes, but make films. And there's nothing to stop them. And there is very little cost involved. I mean, they can borrow a tape camera.
Yeah, the video systems now.
The video system, right. And you can make movies with a tape camera. I mean, you could do the titles. And it's the idea that what I find is doesn't happen too much, at least amongst my own contemporaries, is very few people that I hang out with or know, and that sadly. So is that really sit down and discuss concept. And it starts from there. If someone has an idea... to sit down and write it, get a camera, and then go out and shoot it. There's nothing to stop you.
Meantime, audiences are now seeing you on television in the comedy series, dramatic comedy series, Foley Square. Tell us about your character on the show.
My character is Spiro Papadopoulos. I'm the owner of a Greek restaurant. I sort of fell into this part. Because Spiro Papadopoulos, I mean, I do have a background where my father spoke Greek. I've worked in Greece. I've learned from in all different kinds of situations, one as a bartender in restaurants and liquor stores. And miraculously, I mean, it was sort of a last-minute thing. As I went down and read, it was the final bit of casting. They were trying to find this character. And within hours after that, I found myself at CBS. And within minutes after that, I'd been offer this part. And I thought it was a great adventure for me.
It's a great group of characters. Hector Elizondo.
Hector Elizondo and Margaret Colin and Kathy Silvers and all of them. I mean, yeah, they are a wonderful group.
Dare I suggest that it brings back to TV some of the wonderful ethnic groups that maybe sometimes get homogenized out of the system. Is that a fair comment, do you think? It's something I've noticed about the show.
Well, it takes place in New York, and you know, and as it should be, or any place in the world. Now, I don't think we can limit ethnic groups to New York City. I found tremendous amount. There's a lot of them in Kansas City. I got started at the Jewish Community Center. I mean, I'm not Jewish, but they embraced me and helped me. They put up the money to pay for my first film back there. And a fellow by the name of Leonard Belove, who was then president of the B'nai B'rith, got the boys together and said, let's help this guy. And they came up with $68,000. And I went off and made a Western and built the set inside of a church on Pennsylvania Avenue. I think that's what it was.
I didn't know any of this.
This was an abandoned church, and we had to put braces underneath the floor so it wouldn't collapse.
What year is this?
This was in 1957.
I'll be darned.
1957-58. So I had been active. I had written some plays for the Resident Theater, and I was embraced by that community. And that was, of course, at that time and before then, a very important theater, you know, in Kansas City. Ranked third, I think, in terms of its prestige. And when the time came and I said, I have a script and I'd like to make a movie, they said, all right, let's help them. And they got together and we got $2,000 here and $1,000 there. And I found myself making a Western. In fact, I brought the cameraman back who had shot High Noon. It was shot almost on a union level. The unions back there helped me. I mean, if I needed something, removed power lines, did all kinds of things for me that, you know, you couldn't normally do, because I was a guy trying to get started. And so that's why I have for all the people that are back there in Kansas City, and I have yet to bring another film back to Kansas City. I should.
I was going to say, it's high time.
I just hope that all my friends are still around.
Let's conclude it on that note. You are continuing to direct, not to emphasize the acting over much, because you are still directing, right?
I would much rather play general than work as a as an owner of a restaurant.
Now, it's a made-for-television project, I think, that you're doing now?
The Foley Square, yes.
The movie. Aren't you doing a film now for TV?
I just finished a film about the Statue of Liberty, a three-hour movie, which will be coming on NBC on Easter Sunday, a film that I'm really proud of. I mean, because all of a sudden I'm given the responsibility of explaining what that statue's about. Maybe a lot of us just forgot, you know, and I tried to get into the essence of that in terms of what it represents out there in our harbor.
Richard Serapian, I want to thank you for taking the time to talk with us on those and other diverse topics here at your home in Brentwood, California. I'm always finding it remarkable when people say, sure, come on out and we'll talk a while. I appreciate that a lot.
Well, thank you. I've enjoyed it.
This is John Tibbetts here in the Green Room, coming to you from California. I'll be back with you again next week with another very special guest. Until then, goodbye, everybody. Yeah, we're talking about the bear. All right, you were saying.
And the producer came to me some time, 2 years prior, or a year and a half prior to the actual filming of it, told me about the project. I read it, and we discussed football a little bit. I'm not that much of an aficionado on football, but I did have an approach in trying to get into the game and to get into the character of someone and to the essence of what makes someone the best at what he does. And I sort of ignored the possibility, and then suddenly it came to me, and I had to go down to Tuscaloosa and meet with Mrs. Bryant. I first met with an attorney, and I think I was then evaluated that this guy is okay, good enough. Mm-hmm. I mean, enough, yeah. We can trust him enough to bring him into our home. And by what I was meeting then was a very sophisticated lady who was the wife of this famous man who had since, you know, recently died. And naturally was very protective of her husband and any image that the world had of him. Naturally, she didn't want to see anything negative, anything that would talk about his drinking or his loneliness, the fact that he did carouse and that he was human, like beyond being this superhero. She told me, she said, Mr. Serafian, she said, I would like my country to be proud of this picture. And I said, so would I. She said, I meant Alabama, Mr.
And yet you shot it, what, Tennessee? And
we were not allowed to shoot it in Alabama because the governor of the state wouldn't cooperate with us. He did not want us there. Why? Because the Bryant family and the people around the Bryant family, although Bryant had a contract with us, did not want the picture made. And it would have become more of a problem having them there watching us in this strange situation and the same circumstances, because it wasn't so much that we had to devote ourselves in copying the campus, you know, of the University of Alabama. The architecture that we were able to find was very similar in Georgia, which welcomed us. I mean, the governor of South Carolina sent us his plane so that we would consider filming there. And it wasn't that, well, that was not what I wanted to show. That was not what the picture is about. The picture, as I tried to get into it, got into some of the chronology of events, but events that led the audience into understanding maybe what it was within the man that made him the best at what he did and made him this incredible monolith of a...
Meantime, talking about incredible, Gary Busey. Something about him fascinates me, but I've heard that he can be problematic on a set.
Well, yeah, he's been a bad boy at times, and he's independent, he's singular. I mean, he's a rock and roll artist, and he's a rebel. But again, a man of incredible passion,
yeah.
A tremendous artist. He will a four-dimensional actor, as far as I'm concerned. Oh yeah, he did not give you obvious choices, and you can feel very comfortable, you know, in that. Being as an actor is that he is giving you much more, and he's doing it so deftly. He's not giving you the obvious archetype character. He has tremendous humor. He's probably one of the brightest actors I've ever worked with, brighter than all of them. Again, a child who with a tremendous amount of love who's in him, who tries to reach out, touch people, does it in a lot of ways with his music, has done it in many performances. Buddy Holly was an incredible portrayal there, which he was honored for. And he's gotten into some problems with drugs, you know. And he would come to me, you know, with it, and take his belt off and throw it on the floor, absolutely distraught, because he thought I would be mad at him and expect me to almost spank him as a father. It was like I'm a father-child relationship. Of course, I wouldn't. And he'd come to me tearfully and say, please forgive me. I was always touched by that. I always thought I was dealing with a very sensitive artist. And all you could do with a Gary Busey is to embrace him and encourage him and support him and protect him as much as you can against all the conventions. I mean, if he was late on the set, didn't really matter as far as I was. Gave me more time to light it.
I talked once with Nick Nolte about him, and you're echoing some of the impressions that I got from him.
Good. I would hope that anybody who knows Gary would support the fact that this is a brilliant artist. And
I don't think we even begin to know what he can do.
That's absolutely it. He could do, I would say, most anything. Naturally, there's some things you wouldn't cast him in. But there's a tremendous amount of music in him, a tremendous amount of passion. He does not like to do... He would never hurt anybody around him. I mean, if he has any anger or there's any frustration, it's all directed towards himself. But he's a gentle soul, really gentle soul. I had worked with him years before that in a film called The Lolly Madonna War.
I've never seen it.
And that became it was a picture about two feuding families. He was just a very young man at that time. I don't know, he was in his early 20s and had just been married. That was my first chance to get to work with Gary Busey. And I hope he does a lot of films. I hope that this town goes out and finds him and puts him in important parts.
Did you see the one that he did?